Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're happy to have her back again on the program, Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month, it's always on a Tuesday, she's here on the program, and she talks about things that grow in the home landscape. So it's an opportunity to ask questions. If you have problems, get some advice. Maybe you have a problem from last growing season that you haven't solved yet. You're already thinking about what you might like to plant next time around. Maybe also you have a houseplant question. We can do that too. Any and all of that, certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long distance call, you can use that and we'll pay for the call. And you can also send us an email. And that's address is will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point, you can call in and or write us. And Sandy will see if she can help you out. Thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
I wanted to share with you an email that I got. And I don't know if this was connected with the discussion about Creeping Charlie a couple of weeks ago on Illinois Gardener, because we were asking for people to support the station, and I happened to be there that night. Now maybe it comes up a lot, but there was talk about Creeping Charlie, and so I did get an email from someone who says, I want to put in a good word for the poor Creeping Charlie reputation. I have found that wherever it grows, it actually creates wonderful soil if you're not in a hurry. Plus, it's easy to pull up and actually feels quite rewarding to yank up a whole string of the stuff. I say be happy if you're cultivating Creeping Charlie.
I like that.
And that was what we were talking the other night. I was thinking, oh, just give the poor Creeping Charlie a break. It's green, and it's a lovely purple flower. And if you can just mow it, and then I know many gardeners, if you have big problems, particularly if it's in your flower beds or it's in places you don't want it, then people are just horrified and they'd like to bomb it back to the Stone Age. So,
it does make a nice ground cover. I mean, you know, in those areas, but the problem is, as you were saying, it doesn't let anything else grow. It's kind of, you know, rambunctious, so to speak, and. Yeah. You know, in some areas, you know, if you don't have anything else growing, I actually have found it growing underneath some of my, like, pine trees and some places where a lot of other stuff just won't grow very well, and it seems to do okay. And so, yeah, there you go. There is a group out there that's, you know, all for Charlie. Huh?
A minority, probably.
Probably a minority.
Probably, but that's so. And I guess the thing is that it's one of those things that does well in marginal soil in places where as you say, other stuff won't grow. It's perfectly happy. So, and it's so hard to get rid of.
It has its place. Yeah.
Well, maybe some people would think so. All right, then. Let's hear it for Creeping Charlie. And is it still, if you want to get into a Master Gardener, is it still, can you still have time to do that? Or is it a little too late?
Yeah, we're pretty much through as far as the interview process. But people can check it because in every area, it's a little bit different. Most of the trainings start usually the end of January. So just check with your local extension office. And I'm not sure exactly how they do it even into Indiana and stuff. So you may have time, but I wouldn't wait much later. So just check with your local extension office and see if it's still time to get into the program. And I guess that's one of the things we try to get through the training or do the training, you know, during those, you know, winter months when we're not really active in the garden. So we try to get all that done before, and then we're done by April. So people can get outside and put to use what they just learned.
Yeah, okay. At this point in the year, are there particular things that people could be doing?
Well, I think it's one of those things that's sort of wrapping things up. And I think it's sort of a matter of, if you haven't had a chance to do it yet, you know, maybe this would be a good time because it looks like we're at least going to be above freezing maybe for a little while. Everything from covering strawberries, you know, normally we would have done that usually at the end of November. So if you haven't done that yet, you'd want to go ahead and do and cover strawberries either with straw. And actually, the last couple of years, I've been using pine needles because I have more pine needles than straw. And it seems to be working quite well. So I guess that was one of those things I thought, we don't always have to do a straw. You just want a nice loose mulch for your strawberries, so it's important to go ahead and cover those up. And even things like if you have grafted roses, you don't have to do that with all roses, because if they're on their own rootstock, even if they die to the ground, get killed off by the winter and died to the ground, they'll still sucker up and you'll still have the same rose bush. But if it happens to be a grafted one, of course, if you lose that top part, then what you're going to end up with is whatever it was grafted onto. And usually it's a much different rose than what you had. So if you do have grafted roses, you want to make sure you go ahead and get those covered up as well. And again, we're just really looking for, you know, some nice, like, shredded leaves or something that's really a lightweight mulch. And that's always a pretty good rule of thumb if you're trying to mulch anything, is that it really needs to be a lightweight, something that's not going to mat down too much. That's why shredded leaves work out so nicely, and that they tend to not mat so much. So if you get shredded leaves, and as I said, even pine needles, anything along those lines actually work out quite well for mulch. So if there's anything that's marginal like that, I think I'd be thinking about it. Even butterfly bush, you know, we don't always have really good luck with getting that the whole thing through. So sometimes actually mulching those is good. And also, you know, it's not, you could go ahead and do some pruning. I probably wouldn't do a lot of heavy pruning because we like to do a heavy pruning right before, you know, they start to regrow. So usually we're thinking about February and March to do heavy pruning. But if you have some, you know, maybe this is the best time for you to go ahead and do some pruning on your trees and shrubs, then I'd say, you know, go for it. Certainly anything that blooms early in the season, like any of the shrubs, you'd probably want to wait until after they bloom. So if it blooms early in the season before June, generally you want to do that actually after they bloom. Otherwise, you're going to be, if you prune them now, you're going to be cutting off the flower buds. You're not going to kill them, but you kind of lose what you're growing them for. So I think that's always a good thing, too.
Yeah. Here in the next couple of days, I guess it's going to be a little bit warmer, so you could be doing stuff outside, except I think there's also rain in the forecast.
Yeah.
So it's a... It may be near 50, but if it's raining, you're not going to be
wanting to do stuff
out there.
And I think this is the other time of year that actually this is a great time to be looking for bagworms. And I know, you know, bagworms, they're after, you know, obviously on the evergreens, they're still hard to see even this time of year, but they tend to be even more visible. And the thing that I've noticed is that what will happen is these bagworms will attach themselves. And these are the little guys in the bags that we talk about all the time. So they have their own individual bags. And they love to feed on evergreen trees, but they'll actually feed on other things. They'll feed on maples and a lot of deciduous things. It's kind of wherever they blow in. Now, we don't worry too much about them on maples and stuff because they're not going to kill them off the way they do with evergreens. But the problem is if they're there, then they serve as a source for your evergreens. So this is a time of year. Check your if you've had bagworm problems, check deciduous trees in your yard as well and get rid of those bags because those are the ones that often get overlooked. And then, of course, those are the ones that are going to serve as a source for eggs and new bagworms next year. Because they'll blow around, you know, once they go ahead and hatch out in the end of June. So I think this is a really good time to go ahead and do that. So look for bagworms. And, you know, what else are you doing this time of year? Go around, pick off a few bagworms, you know. Makes you feel better. Speaking of Creeping Charlie, I mean, it just makes you feel better. Get rid of the bags and one more thing to do, huh?
Okay. Sandy Mason's here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension, Champaign County. Once a month on a Tuesday, she's on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, and we talk about things that grow in the home landscape. Also, houseplant questions, we can do that as well. Whatever's on your mind, you got a problem, need a suggestion maybe for a particular plant, for a particular spot, you can call in and tell us all about it. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So either of those numbers. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. You can write to will-talk@illinois.edu. I still, you know, had done some around my house. I don't do too much raking, but I go over stuff with the lawnmower and chop up leaves. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do one last time and somehow didn't get to it. Never quite got to it. And now I'm wondering now, is it going to be okay? Because I have a few spots where there are some leaves that are still sitting there. And I'm wondering now, do I actually want to try and find if there will be a day when I can get out there and either just rake a little bit or get out the lawnmower? Or should I just say, okay, fine. It's December now. I'm done with that, and I won't worry about it.
Yeah, I know that's the feeling. We all want to be sort of done with it. But I think probably the biggest thing, if you're still seeing some grass blades and stuff sort of through the leaves, I'm not sure I'd worry about it too much. It's really when it also depends on what kind of leaves you have, but especially if you have a lot of maple leaves that tend to really mat. And if those are really thick in certain spots, those you definitely want to probably either rake up or somehow just at least lessen whatever the depth is on those. But if you're still, you know, got a few leaves out there and still seeing the grass blades, I wouldn't worry about it too much, but it definitely is when it's really thick. And when we start talking about maybe 4, 5, 6 inches, you know, it really starts to add up. That's when you're going to have problems because you can get a mold that will grow under there. So it's not just smothering them, but actually there's a mold that will grow underneath those too that it actually can cause problems with the lawn as well. So there's a couple of reasons why we wouldn't want to do that. Leave it there.
All right. Let's take a call. Urbana, line number one.
Hi, I have a question about winterizing with burlap. I see a couple of yards around town that have put burlap over some plant or other, and I was reading online that one could wrap burlap around sensitive things, like I have some new little Hinoki cypresses that I want to protect. But then I was worried about, would the burlap, once covered with snow and rain, not press down on them?
Yeah, and that's really a good question. And really what the burlap is really good for, especially for things like your cypress, any of the evergreen, like broadleaf evergreens, rhododendrons, or boxwoods, because for a lot of those plants, they hate our winter winds. And we always have wind during the wintertime. And so, and especially if you're in a, and I'm not sure, depending on how windy your site is, if it's not all that terribly windy, I'm not sure I'd worry about it too terribly much. But I think you make a good point, is you really don't want the burlap actually touching the plant. I've seen people do it that way, but it's just like what you were mentioning, the fact that you get ice or snow or and it starts to pack onto the burlap, then it really can create some issues where you get some branch breakage just from the weight. So it's really better off. You're really trying to produce a wind break is what you're trying to do. So you'd put it, hopefully, a foot or so away from it so it's actually not touching the plant. So well, I think you're on the right track.
I built a little teepee of stakes and draped it around that, but it's, of course, on the sides touching the branches. But then there's the question of, is it depriving them of sun?
Well, not so much. You know, this time of year, we don't worry about that too much because they're really not photosynthesizing all that much to the point. They're really sort of hanging out, the evergreens are. So that's not so much of an issue. So I think it sounds like you've given it good support, so that would help. So people, it is to the point where it's touching. At least you've got support there where most of the weight is actually going to be on the structure, it sounds like, from what you're describing. So I think you're fine with that, but it's not something I'd leave on long term at all. And so it's, I don't know when you put this on. It definitely is one of those things we'd want to wait. And, you know, usually December is a pretty good time. And then, of course, you'd want to probably take it off in February or something. You really want to make it a very short period of time when you actually have them that way.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right,
very good. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There are also some things that you would suggest that people do try to protect from critters that might like to be chewing on them. Maybe this is true of things that you that are young and they're still are getting established.
Yeah, I think especially if you put out any new shrubs this past year, I would definitely be putting chicken wire or some kind of wiring around them because rabbits always seem to want to pick on those plants, in particular the young ones. And, of course, those are the ones that will tolerate it the least because they have the least root system. So if you can cover those, that helps immensely. And when I say cover, it's just, again, you're just trying to protect them. And if you can make, ideally, it should be about 3 feet tall, which I know seems really tall, but just to make sure that because rabbits will sit on top. You know, if you have a foot of snowfall around those areas, they'll sit on top and they'll eat from there. So, you know, they can actually eat pretty high into a plant. So try to cover them as best you can with chicken wire or hardware cloth or some kind of wiring. So they love anything new for the most part, but they love anything in the rose family. So especially things like if you have new fruit trees, you know, apples, peaches, all that kind of stuff, they love chewing on those. And even things like voles and mice will chew on those in the wintertime. And so if you have something that has a fine mesh to it in the wiring, that really helps immensely. So you can also keep out mice and other things that might chew on them. Even things like raspberries, roses, they love roses, anything like that. And so it's better to do it now rather than walking out there, you know, come springtime and realize they've chewed down half your plant. They seem to love euonymus, like the burning bushes, those kind of plants in particular. So there isn't, I guess there's not a whole lot of things they don't love. But, you know, if they're hungry enough, they're going to, and there's a snow cover, they're going to eat whatever's available. So, yeah, so it's a good idea to do that now. And it's much better to do that than try to do repellents. There certainly are repellents out there. And you can get some, you know, halfway decent control using repellents. But if they're hungry enough or it's been long enough since you applied the repellent, they're going to eat right through it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really give you 100% like some sort of wiring would.
Yeah, that's sort of the problem with it. I think that maybe people would say that they had success with particular kinds of repellents. But
right.
there's no substitute for as physical barrier between the animals and the plants. Yeah. And if you do have a problem, particularly if there are things that are tender and they're getting settled in, there's not much, but you got to put a cage around them. That's pretty much what you have to do.
Right. And it truly is one of those things that depends on the population. Depends on the population of the rabbits. You know, what else do they have to eat? Is there snow cover? So there's a lot of times maybe certain things might have worked for you, but then if the population's really high and you have all these other pressures, then it doesn't work anymore when it comes to repellents. So I think it's always a good idea to go ahead and do that. And actually, the U of I Extension has, I think, an excellent website called Living with Wildlife. And if you go to that website, I think it's really good in the sense that it gives you, if you think you're having a particular problem with an animal, whatever it is, skunks, raccoons, whatever, they give you, you know, information on about that particular animal, its habits, and then what you can do. And a lot of it has to do with just changing the habitat and doing some changes like that to make sure that you don't have those kind of problems, or at least lessen those kind of problems you might have with wildlife. And I had a woman call yesterday about a woodpecker that was starting to really pick on her, the side of her house.
Oh,
she had a cedar house,
yes.
And he was just really, really going for it. So sometimes it's tough, and usually it's a matter with all the wildlife. It's usually a matter you have to do several things. It's not just one thing, some sort of magic thing. So it's usually several things of scare devices, things like that, that help you.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true. Well, around a place like Champaign-Urbana, if you live around the edges of the cities, you're right there at the interface of rural and urban, and even now, because we've got lost a lot of habitat. There are a lot of animals that are moving into the city and that are really learning how to live with people. And that, well, as far as we're concerned, that causes a problem. They're just trying to make a living. But you can expect that more and more folks are going to have those kinds of issues.
Yeah. And wherever we are, there's plenty of food to eat, usually.
Yeah.
I mean, either garbage or somebody's feeding the birds. Feeding the birds is, you know, a lot of animals like to take like to take advantage of that. People like to feed, unfortunately, like to leave food out for wild cats or whatever. And so that's a perfect opportunity for skunks and raccoons and all kinds of things to come in. So, you know, sometimes we kind of create some of these issues ourselves. But.
Yeah. Well, we're here open to questions. If you have questions about things that grow in the home landscape or houseplants, Sandy Mason is the guest. She's horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month, it's always a Tuesday, she is here, and we take questions. And whatever's on your mind, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. This is a little bit late, but I guess I was thinking about the last time that we were on when you made the point about some of the flowering plants that we grow here as annuals. We think of them as, you know, you buy them in the springtime or in the early part of the summer, you put them in the ground, they flower, and then frost comes and they're done.
Mm-hmm.
That they're actually in other places, if it's warm enough, those are perennials. And now if you haven't done this, it's too late. But that there are a number of things like that you can actually dig up out of the ground, pot them up. And if you have a good place inside where they're going to get plenty of sun, you can actually bring them inside. You can keep them, should be able to keep them through the wintertime. And then come spring, they can go back outside again, and they're just fine with that.
Yeah. And that's true for a lot of the plants that we do think about, whether it's impatiens. I still have impatiens blooming in my basement. I just brought the pot in, and it's still blooming away, and it doesn't know that it's gotten too cold outside. So in geraniums, there's lots and things like that we could actually bring indoors if we wanted to. And maybe even have some pansies still outside, and those have been pretty tough, and they would have probably survived the last few weeks that we've had. Those could certainly still be brought indoors and continue to flower, usually. Once it starts to get really cold, they kind of quit flowering, but sometimes they'll actually come back the next spring for those. But they're pretty cold tolerant, so that's the good part. So there's a lot of plants along those lines. So sometimes it's just really fun to bring those in. I think one of the things is just to bring plants indoors. I just find it's easier, or not maybe not easier, it just makes me feel better having live plants indoors, you know, this time of year. I think we're all, I'm looking for a greenhouse. What do you think?
That sounds pretty good. Your husband's pretty handy. Have him build you one.
Build a greenhouse.
You got plenty of projects for him, I'm sure.
I know.
333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have somebody on a cell phone from over in Indiana on our toll free line here, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You had mentioned earlier about using pine needles as mulch, and I'm really not much of a gardener, but I'd always heard that you had to be careful with pine needles because of the acidic. I guess I'm calling more for my wife, who uses a lot of straw and so forth. So are pine needles okay to use in about any application? Because we have a lot of pine needles around.
Now, I really like using pine needles, and I know that's kind of the feeling. Everybody thinks that they're too acidic, but it's really, you'd have to do it for a very long period of time. And actually, soil pH is pretty buffered because of all the organic matter and stuff, so it's actually hard to change soil pH. So that's a long answer to your short question. I wouldn't worry about pine needles as far as making the soil more acidic. We tend to find pine trees in more acidic areas, and so I think people have kind of just assumed there's association. But it really isn't. And so I'm with you. I have plenty of pine needles. I don't have a lot of straw. Pine needles, I like pine needles because they don't break down very fast. And the thing that I have found with straw is when I do with my strawberries, I tend to get a lot of slugs in the straw. Well, the slugs don't seem to like pine needles. So for me, at least, I think it's actually helped my slug issues when it comes to strawberries. So that's kind of my two cents. And I'd say if you've got pine needles, go for it.
Okay, well, I like that. That'll save me a little money.
See, there you go.
Okay, well, I guess one more question. This is more of a grass thing. Seems like in the last 2 years, more and more crabgrass. And I don't really spend a lot of time. We have a lot to mow, and I don't worry about it too much. But can I just go out there, like, say, right now, and take a heavy rake and just kind of rough up the ground a little bit, then sow grass seed, and then just leave it alone, not putting down or anything like that, and that grass will let sort of do okay or not?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't do that with usually we say for if you're going to do Kentucky bluegrass, it's really best to do it more in the warmer period. So it'd be like, usually we say August, September is about the last time of the season that you'd really want to do Kentucky bluegrass because it's notoriously slow under cold soils. So I wouldn't use Kentucky bluegrass if you really, really wanted to do that. So I would wait till April probably if you're going to do Kentucky bluegrass. You could probably get away with that if you really feel like you want to go ahead and do it. You probably get away with it with maybe something like perennial ryegrass, some of the other that's more vigorous when it comes to seedling. But generally, we don't recommend that for lawn-type grasses. But if it's something you just feel like you want to do, or if somebody really has a muddy spot and they want to kind of, you know, make it not quite so muddy, I just wouldn't use Kentucky bluegrass. Perennial ryegrass, which is not a good necessarily long-term grass, but a good short-term. And then annual ryegrass would be the other one. It's not a good long-term grass, but it's a good short-term grass if you're just trying to get something in an area. So I think it almost sounds like from your you're just trying to thicken up your lawn, I think you'd probably be better off to wait till April and actually use a good mix and have it during a time period when it's going to germinate quickly for you.
But I don't need to get in there and, like, actually, I don't really want to start, like, digging out the crabgrass. Renting something to aerate it. I just want to, like, do it real quick.
No. And actually, probably the big thing, you just need to get good seed-to-soil contact. So if the seed, if it's open enough, and crabgrass is an annual, so it has to come back every year from seed. So those plants are goners anyway, so those plants aren't going to come back. So if you can see the soil, then I would just sort of, you know, if you can have like a garden rake or something that's sort of roughing it up a little bit once you put the seed down, then that's fine. But you don't have to do any major like tilling or any of that kind of stuff. But so if you can see the soil, then just if you can just somehow, sometimes people just use, you know, like a piece of chain link fence or something to sort of work the soil up a little bit on the top and then get the seed down in there, then you're fine. You don't have to do anything major. If you're seeing sod where there just truly isn't any soil visible, then you're going to have to do something a little bit more intensive. And whether it's, you can actually rent these things called slit seeders that actually put a slit in the soil and then drop the seed down in there. You just need to make sure the seed gets down into the soil and however you end up doing that. Okay.
Thanks a lot for your.
Sure.
All right. Very good. Right. Thank you. And other folks, you had questions for our guest, Sandy Mason, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I think earlier this summer we were talking about the fact that it had been really dry, and in my yard, and I'm sure a lot of other places, they had brown dead patches in their grass, and I think that you said, well, be prepared that even if things turn around and it cools off and we start getting some rain, those places might not come back. And I have some places like that. So if so, it's now it's too late to do anything about that. Mm-hmm. When at one point in the spring would you say, okay, now if you have some places that you'd like to get some seed started, when do you start thinking about that?
Yeah, usually April is a pretty good time to think about that in most areas, because you want, as I, you know, Kentucky bluegrass and actually some of the other grasses, they're just, they don't like cool soils. They don't germinate well in cool soil. So if you put it down when the soil's too cool, it kind of just sits there, and then you're not sure, you know, what kind of germination rate you're going to get. So you're better off waiting until April. And it is one of those things. You really kind of have to look at the situation. If it's mostly crabgrass, as this gentleman was talking about, a lot of times that pretty well is open, because once a crabgrass dies, being an annual, it's pretty well open soil. There isn't a whole lot left there. So you could go ahead and do that. Probably the big thing is that sometimes people have to decide on whether they want to do a pre-emergence herbicide, whether they're going to do that for crabgrass because they're concerned about that, or whether they're going to seed. So you really, there's only one product that you can do both at the same time. But generally, we recommend that people decide one way or the other. Either you're going to seed in the spring, or you're going to use some sort of pre-emergent to take care of crabgrass and other types of annual grassy weeds. So you kind of have to make that decision. If your grass is pretty thick, then you may decide that, you know, but you just have a little bit of crabgrass, then maybe you decide to go ahead and use a pre-emergence, and then just let the existing grass sort of thicken up and fill in.
So in those places where it seems like the grass is just dead,
right,
what do you need to try to get in there and rake that up and remove some of the, at least that dead stuff, so that you can get down to some bare soil?
Yeah, again, usually with crabgrass is so, you know, it seems to be one of those that it, for the most part, it kind of makes a little bit of a clump. By the time it kind of dies up, it's a little bit of a clump. So most of the time, you can seed right into it just by raking or something like that, and not worry too much about getting rid of those plants, because they're just going to decompose and they're fine, because they're annuals. Those plants aren't going to come back. So you kind of have to decide again on how thick the lawn is or the sod is. It's just, you can't just put grass on the top of an existing lawn and expect it to germinate. It's got to be where it hits the soil. So you got to get that good seed to soil contact in order for it to do well. So, you know, it's like planting, what I say, it's like planting lettuce or tomatoes or anything like that. You got to make sure that, you know, the seed's down into the soil, or you're not going to have good success. And lawn grass is the same way. It needs to get down in there with the soil. Probably one of the biggest problems we've seen over the last few years is actually a perennial grassy weed called nimblewill. And a lot of people have seen that over the last few years. And unfortunately, it is a perennial, so the same plant comes back every year. Plus, it produces lots and lots and lots of seeds. But it's a very fine leaf blade, and so it looks very different than Kentucky bluegrass. And then plus it, what people will notice is it's a warm season grass, and so it has to wait until the weather's nice and warm. So in the springtime, people will notice, well, there's this grass here, but it's not greening up like the Kentucky bluegrass and the perennial ryegrass. And a lot of times that's nimblewill, and it doesn't start to green up usually till May. And then it'll green up, and then as soon as we start getting some cool temperatures in the fall, then it goes dormant again because it's a warm season grass. And so again, you have these brown patches. These same patches now are brown. So that's a completely different story because it's a perennial. So I guess that's the big rule of thumb, is just making sure you know what you're working with and what the problem really is. Is it crabgrass? Is it nimblewill? Is it, you know, tall fescue? You know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's actually where extension offices, and there's a lot of organizations too out there that can help you with identification. That's probably one of the big things, is really find out what it is. And then you'll have a much better idea on how to control it, or how to deal with it, or how to live with it.
Sandy Mason is the guest here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. That's our monthly show on lawn and garden care. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Have you turned to WILL to help keep you informed of current events in our country and around the world? You might turn to WILL to get up-to-date information about financial and agricultural markets. These are just a few examples of the range of programming services found on WILL. Please consider making an additional pledge of support today. Your gift will help us continue to offer comprehensive news and information programs. Make your contribution online at willpledge.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, he's at the controls this hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Let me just mention that in hour two, we will be talking about what some schools in our area are doing to try to battle childhood obesity, which we know is a growing problem. And we'll have three guests. Cheryl McIntyre will be with us. She's the principal of Northeast Elementary School in Danville, the school that has won some national recognition for working in this area. Wendy Starwalt, she's the coordinator for elementary physical education for Unit 4, will be here, as well as Craig Gunderson, who's professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the U of I. That's in the second hour today. Tomorrow, not unrelated, we'll talk with Susan Kundrat. Celeste Quinn will be hosting. This is our monthly show on nutrition, and the two of them will be talking about managing weight and eating lightly over the winter. And, of course, any questions you have that have to do with diet, nutrition, are welcome. One more, I'll mention Wednesday, tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, Rich Warren will be here. He's a columnist with the News Gazette and has a regular regular column there, and then occasionally is here on this show, and we talk about consumer electronics. Maybe you're thinking about a new television set or ways that you record television shows to watch later or CD player, or maybe you even still have records. Remember those, kids? And you're thinking about a new turntable. Any and all of that. We'll do that tomorrow, and Rich will help you out and give you some advice on selecting new equipment. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. And the guest in this hour is Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Monthly, on a Tuesday, she is on this program, and we talk about things that grow in the home landscape. So maybe you have a problem from last growing season. You're thinking about the next season. You have a houseplant issue. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. You can call us 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So what do you do to keep yourself inspired through the winter time when you're not doing stuff outside?
Yeah, I read. I love going through. I love looking through catalogs. There's just something about it. There's just something about it. And actually, I think even if, you know, whether you're been gardening for a long time or whether you're a novice gardener, I think catalogs are actually a good source of information in a lot of respects. Well, most of the catalogs are. I shouldn't say all of them. But it kind of gives you an idea what's out there and what kinds of. And I love going through the catalogs to see what's new and different and what kinds of things that people are really into these days. And And I think we're seeing a lot of different things going on. I think one of the things that we see, we're seeing more and more, and this has been over the last few years, is that the interest in container gardening. So I see more and more plants that are really meant for containers, vegetables that could be grown in containers. So this whole idea of sort of smaller, especially when it comes to vegetables, sort of this idea of having smaller gardens. So things that will fit in smaller spaces, tomatoes that'll fit in a hanging basket. I mean, we've got a lot of those kind of things that are going on. And I think that kind of reflects what a lot of people are doing these days, where they're not having a 3-acre garden. You know, that's pretty rare at this point. So most people are going with smaller gardens or containers or whatever. So I think that's kind of fun to see what's going on that way. And I think just the whole sort of multi-use, I think we're seeing a lot more plants, especially in a lot of the ornamentals, where it's really the foliage. You know, we always think about flowers, you know, or at least for the many, many years thought about flowers. But now it's the foliage is as much as the flowers these days. And I like that in the sense that you don't have to wait for the flower to appear or whatever it is. So we're seeing a lot more of those kind of things. So I think it's just kind of fun to see what's out there. Yeah. What's going on?
I know a lot of people are interested in container gardening because maybe they live in an apartment or they live in a house and they really don't have a lot of yard. They really don't have the opportunity. They don't have the acreage to put stuff into the ground. So for people like that, well, you can still grow things. You can grow things in containers. But even if you do have the space, are there some particular advantages to working with containers? And you would say, well, so you have some dirt out there you can put things in, but there might be reasons that you would say for certain sorts of things, doing it in a container actually makes a lot of sense.
You know, I think part of it is certainly, you know, maybe folks just feel like they can't, you know, for whatever reason, feel like they don't want to work in a bed that where they have to get down on their hands and knees or whatever. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's just access. It's just easier with containers is that they're usually up, you know, they're up higher. You can put them as high as you want, or you can even just stand and then work in them. Plus the fact that with containers, they for the most part, you're not going to see weeds. You're not going to be pulling any weeds out there generally with containers. So people really like that aspect to it. So, and there might be some issues sometimes that people are in a particularly urban area where they just feel like they're not quite sure about their soil, as in, you know, maybe it had some industrial uses in the past. We know lead paint was commonly used in houses, and so maybe you're in an older urban area, so you're a little bit concerned about the soil quality. And so maybe containers works out much better, and then you don't have to worry about those kind of concerns. And even just things like raised beds, I think we're seeing more and more interest in raised beds, which I really like. I've raised beds at home. And again, we're back to that whole idea of sort of accessibility, where it's just easier. And for the most part, you know, if you have raised beds, especially, is that you're not walking on them. You're not. So the soil tends to stay nice, and you have a really good structure in the soil simply because you're not walking on it. You're not tilling it. You're not doing all the things that sometimes can really destroy the structure of the soil. So that's kind of nice, too. So I think there's a lot of reasons why people have kind of gone to those rounds.
Well, if so, you're going to you think, well, maybe you're going to do that, and you go down to the place where they sell plants and all the mm-hmm. stuff that you need. And then I'm sure that there's an aisle where you see various kinds of stuff to put into your container. There's potting soil, there's soilless stuff, there's stuff that has fertilizer already in it. I'm sure that you can just buy bags of dirt. Do you have particular strong feelings one way or another about what it is that you then put into your containers?
Yeah, I think the one thing, especially with containers, when we're actually talking about containers, even if it's several gallons, you really want to make sure that you get a soil that's meant for containers. Mm-hmm. If you just put your, even if you have great garden soil, if you just stick it in a container, everything sort of changes. The whole dynamics of the system changes. And so good old soil that was good and well-drained and all that kind of good stuff out in your garden suddenly turns into a rock in a container. So it's very different. So you really have to make sure you have a very lightweight mix. So usually that's a matter of just having stuff, you know, whether you have vermiculite or perlite or something else mixed into it. A lot of times people like the soilless mixes because they tend to be ones that actually work out quite well. They hold moisture, but yet they drain well, those kind of things. So you kind of have to find those things. But a lot of those add-ons, as in fertilizer in it, all that kind of stuff, it's convenience. You know, it's like a lot of things these days. We're paying for the convenience, so we don't have to think about it. But you could add your own if you wanted to, add your own fertilizer, and it's a little bit cheaper that way. So you kind of have to decide on, you know, again, we all make those decisions, don't we? Is it worth the convenience? Yeah. Or I'd rather save a little money and do my own. But the fact that with containers, you have to water them generally more, especially if they're smaller containers, you have to water them more, which means you generally are going to have to fertilize them more. So you have to kind of think through that a little bit too. So there's a little bit of maintenance thing with containers that you don't necessarily get with garden beds where you're going to have to water them more often. So you kind of have to think through that.
Okay. Here's a caller in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I have two of those half barrels that you get at Menards, you know, uh-huh. those containers. And my plan, I got a second one, and a couple of years ago, I bought a rolling platform that pretty nearly fits. You know, it's just slightly bigger than the bottom of that container. Mm-hmm. And that's great, so I can roll that around because I have a covered patio. And, you know, so I wanted to be able to roll it where I want. And then the other one is still sitting in front of my house, but I transferred the soil from the first one into the second one when it was already on the rolling platform. But the problem is, I want a rolling platform for the second one, but whatever it is out there, FS out on East University, they no longer have those, and I couldn't find them at any of the big box stores. And I wondered if you could give me a clue as to where I could get something that I could put this half barrel on and be able to roll it.
Oh, wow. Hmm. Good question. I can't help but think there isn't something along those lines that's meant for something else. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm thinking, but I'm not sure they're separate now that I think about it. You know, they have the rolling, like, waste paper, not waste paper, you know, like garbage pails.
Yeah, trash cans.
Trash cans, those kind of things.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure those come off.
No, those don't come off.
But I would just...
I did find one thing at Rural King that's like... it's rectangular,
mm-hmm.
a rectangular platform that I think it would fit. You know, it would be too short one way and too long the other way, but I think it could sit on there. But I was wondering if you had any idea where I could find something.
You may, I don't know how handy you are. But you can buy, you know, you could buy casters and then just put it on a, you know, outdoor grade, you know, plywood or something. Because you're not going to see it, I assume. You're going to have it so it's not really seen.
I mean, the thing is you have to have it either a little bigger or a little smaller than that because it has a little rim around the bottom.
Right.
So it either has to fit inside that rim or the rim has to sit on the platform.
Right.
So it would be a lot easier to be able to see it because then you wouldn't have to be so exact.
Right. Yeah, I'm afraid this, if you've checked locally and it just doesn't seem like anybody has them, you may find you have to get them online and kind of look through that way. Other than making your own, I just can't think of anything else that's sort of like separate.
What would you look for online?
I would just look for, any of the, I don't know whether they just be called container dollies. I don't know. What do they call them?
No, that's, I guess I'm not sure. I would think you might also try Farm and Fleet to see what they might have, in northeast Urbana. I know that they do have casters in a range of sizes, sometimes just the most gigantic things you ever saw. I don't know if it would be possible actually to attach the casters to the bottom of the container.
Oh, rather than
having it sitting on something.
Well, that's true.
Could you put the casters onto the half barrel?
There you go.
So, you know, screw them or bolt them onto the bottom.
Because you'd have to drill some holes, but
I would think that might be a possibility. So make your barrel movable in and of itself.
I don't know what to tell you. But I think it is one of those things that I find myself sort of wandering the aisles of some of the like box stores and Farm and Fleet and all those kind of places because you'd be amazed that there's these things out there that were meant for something else but is actually quite useful for something.
Well, I mean, Rural King is a lot like
in the garden. I'm not sure what to tell you on that, but I would think. I don't know. I think probably just container dollies or something like that. If you just search them online, I'm not sure what else to tell you on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not one of those things that has a really distinct name, you know?
Yeah, at least not one that's coming to my mind. So, well, good luck.
Yeah, all right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, let's go to Paris for the next caller here. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Questions and try to make them quick. I have a friend that has 2 different issues, and I told her I'd call in and find out about them. She has, this year, she got some small Japanese maples and planted them in large pots.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to figure out the other day where we should stick them for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her I thought they ought to stay outside so that they would stay dormant and just kind of, we've got them pushed up beside some boxwood, you know, and it's kind of in a protected place. But I told her I don't think we ought to put them inside because I didn't know if that would be a good, and the soil might dry out too much.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would just say you're on the right track because any of the trees and shrubs and stuff that are meant for this temperate zone, like what we're in, they need to go through a cold period. That's just part of what they are. So you're absolutely right. Just to bring it indoors is not a good idea.
Okay. The other question, she planted some ever-bearing strawberries in this. It's like, it kind of reminds you of a strawberry jar, only it's tall. It's probably about 3.5-4 foot tall, and then it has pretty good sized pockets up and down the sides of it. And she planted strawberries in it, and I had 2 concerns about it. I didn't know how well this thing's going to hold up with our weather, with the freeze and thaw. And then she had thought about trying to stick that in a greenhouse, and the same thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it needed that dormant period, you know, better outside. And then we thought about trying to cover it up, you know, with a blanket. And I'm like, no, because that would be heavy and wet. And I didn't think that would be such a hot idea. So I really just didn't know what to tell her.
Yeah. Well, I think you have good instincts with this in the sense that these plants need to go through a cold period. They need a chilling period in order to do well. So we can't just bring them in and protect them that way. So I think you're on the right track that way. I assume with both of these containers, these are not ceramic or anything where they're going to crack up in the winter. So
the strawberry one is it's beautiful because it's this beautiful blue thing that she got. And it's really, really nice. And that's why I told her I hate to see it, you know, fall apart because of the weather, but she wanted to plant strawberries in it, and I'm like, well, okay, but
Yeah,
it's a free thaw thing, and I thought that can't be good.
Yeah, does she have any place where she could actually just put it, but yet it wouldn't get rained on or anything? Does she have like an unheated porch or something like that where it wouldn't actually get rained on?
She bought a small greenhouse, like one of the little plastic greenhouses you kind of walk in, you know, but it's not very big.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought about moving it to that. My concern is the weight of this puppy trying to move it with the dirt and everything like that in it. I mean, if we had put it there originally and built a greenhouse over top of it, it might work. But being the situation as it is now, I don't see how we'd be able to move the doggone thing.
Yeah, right. You need casters for yours. The other lady was talking about casters.
Right. The topic of the day.
Yeah. I think probably the biggest thing is that because it's ceramic, and if it's one that you don't know whether it's meant to be, you know, left outdoors, if it gets rained on, it's gonna bust apart more than likely. It's just that freezing and thawing is going to bust apart, and that would be a very sad thing.
Yeah,
so, that's why I was thinking if there was some place she could put it where it'd still go through the chilling, but it wouldn't get this regular rain, which would cause the, you know, lots of water to the sensor where it would bust up.
Plastic over it?
She could. That's not really good for the plants is the only thing, because
that's
if you put plastic over it, then what can happen is, of course, it'll heat up inside of the air, and then the plants will think it's, you know, time to come out, and then you'll get them. They'll be so messed up they don't know whether to grow or not to grow. So I think you're going to, it almost sounds like you're going to lose one by trying to save the other one, no matter what you're doing here. So
That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah.
Pick your brain and your expertise, and maybe you could tell me something good.
Yeah, I guess you have to decide on what you want to, which you're concerned about losing the most. But if there was some place where she could put it, but it sounds like it's hard to move, but if there was some way to sort of protect it, you know, if you want to go ahead and put plastic over it and hope for the best with the strawberries, you can certainly replace those later if they don't make it through the winter. But it might be easier to replace the strawberries than the pot, it sounds like.
Okay, all right, that's kind of what I thought.
Right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, for the last caller, what you're looking for is something called a plant dolly. And if you have internet access, just put that into your browser, and I'll bet you'll find a lot of places to buy them. I'm looking at some right here. They're round. They come in different sizes. They have casters on the bottom. They have a hole to allow for the draining. And in fact, they have one here, for example, that's a 24-inch plant dolly. It says it's perfect for whiskey barrels, large garden pots. A 24-inch plant dolly has 6 wheels, can hold up to 500 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
And are great at preventing large rings on your patio or deck by getting large barrels off the ground and floor. And that, for example, that one costs $40. So go online, plant dolly. And actually a caller called in and suggested a moving dolly, and they do actually have them for use if you are going to move furniture, but that's a different animal. This is the thing you want. You want the one that's for plants. So do that.
So there you go. Now we all know.
Trying to be helpful. we'll go over to Belgium here. Let's talk with the caller, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
And just to add to the plant dolly thing, I've made many of them. And it's best to have 3 wheels for most small ones, because then you have a plane and you don't get tippy-tippy on them.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
And
I use exterior-grade plywood, and you can make them square, round, triangular, oblong, whatever shape you want. Cut them up to whatever you want. But the question I was, you can get all the parts at Menards or Lowe's, all those places. They all have small casters. Get the swivel kind so you can steer it around your floor better. But they're very simple to make, 4 or 5 screws in each one. But the question, the thing I was going to talk about, last month when I talked to you folks, we were talking about plants in strange places. Well, over Thanksgiving weekend, I went to Taiwan. And I went to a national park in Taiwan, walked through a beautiful area there, and came upon poinsettias that were about the size of redbud trees.
Oh, wow.
They're all over. It's amazing. I go, my goodness, that's the biggest poinsettia I've ever seen. Another interesting thing I noticed was you'd see banana trees right next to sweet corn. That's kind of...
That seems really odd, doesn't it?
No.
Not going to see that around here, I'm sure. No. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Their gardens are considerably different than ours.
Yeah.
Obviously, they plant different things, but they may get a range of things because they're right on the Tropic of Cancer, so it's right next to the Tropic, right next to Temperate Zone, so you get a huge mixture of different types of plants. which I thought was very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's great. Well, that's great having that opportunity to travel because you get that little different perspective, don't you?
You definitely do. Take care.
Thanks.
Well, I'm sure people are probably always envious if you go to a zone more south of where you are, you start seeing things that will grow. And I know I've had that same experience, though, with people who live more north of here, like in the upper Midwest. They see some of the stuff that we have and they say, well, we couldn't grow that. And we do the same thing if we go down to someplace in Florida or in the southern United States. We think, well, gosh, wouldn't it be great to grow certain kinds of things? And we just can't
do it because it just gets cold. In Florida, they wish they could grow tulips and daffodils and stuff like that, but they have a hard time with that because they don't have a cold period. In some of those areas. So we're never happy, are we?
Be grateful for what you have. speaking of that, I know this is goofy. We always ask that just right up until the time when the soil is so hard that you would have to have a chisel. But can you still, if you wanted to plant spring bulbs, can you still do that?
I would, absolutely. And right now, you know, it's just a little bit of freezing on the top, but there's still plenty. You can still go ahead and get them in the ground. Yeah. So I would absolutely do it. So,
how critical for those things is planting depth? So I have done, you know, planted a lot of things like that. And I guess I have tried to get it about what they recommend, but I have not gone to the point of getting a stick, you know, and if it says 8 inches, make sure that it really is 8 inches. How critical is it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just recently, and I wish I could remember what university it was, did a study looking at tulips and just planting them very shallowly, and they actually did quite well. They did fine. But it's that long term, you know, what happens long term. So in other words, if you're just planting them, like a lot of park districts and stuff, just plant tulips or whatever just for short term show. You know, they're just going to grow. Then they don't care if they come back the next year or whatever. You probably don't have to worry too much about depth. And it may not be as big an issue as what we think it is. But I think especially with tulips, they found they will last longer, as in more years, if you get them at that 6 to 8 inches deep. Yeah. Okay. So I think that's certainly part of it. So,
well, I guess we're just about at the point we can wrap up for this time around with the promise that Sandy will be back in January, but we think we may do a little bit
later.
Of a change. So it probably will be a week later, but she will be here in January. And in the meantime, if you're interested in gardening, you might want to tune in for the program that we have called, now what is it now? It's
Mid-American Gardener.
See, my problem is for a million years, it was Illinois Gardener, and I can't get that out of my head. Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV, Thursday nights at 7 o'clock. Diane Nolan is host. Sandy is occasionally on the show, and other folks from the university and people who are master gardeners and people who work in the various landscaping and garden shops. It's always somebody different, but it's a live show, and it's an opportunity to call in and ask plant questions, and we do that show year-round. So, so you want to tune in. Thursday nights, WILL-TV, 7 o'clock.
Okay.
Hey, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.